Good day, everyone, and welcome to the 23rd presentation of Inside the Beltway. Now, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Fred Riche. Fred, please go ahead.
Debbie, thank you very much, and hello, everybody. Welcome to this year's Beltway. We've been doing this for almost 6 years now, and I want to thank you for your support. With me today is Jim Lundy from our Chicago office. Jim is an SEC attorney that's going to be talking about some of the developments at the SEC on the best interest standard of care and also their examination priorities. Brad Campbell, who's in our Washington, D.C. office, the former assistant secretary at the Department of Labor, will be joining us in a few minutes. And, of course, Brad and I will be talking about the DOL and the fiduciary rule and what we think some of the problems are with what we're seeing with efforts to comply with the fiduciary rule. Jim Dolan, who is the vice president at NetTixis, who graciously sponsors this conference. Before getting to Jim, though, I just want to let you know that the session today is being recorded, and those recordings will be available to registrants. So anybody who registered for the program will be able to access the recording, and will, in fact, get an email when it's posted about a week from now. So you can expect to get a link via an email if you or some of your compatriots want to listen to this program. It will also be available, in case you lose the email or accidentally delete it, the recording will also be available on our website, which is www.drinkermiddle, that's the name of the firm, drinkermiddle, no space, no periods, drinkermiddle.com. There's a tab called Insights and Events, and you would look under that tab. But allow a few days to go by before you look there, because it takes a little while for us to get it up there. Okay, now let me introduce Jim Dolan again. As I said, Jim is the Vice President for Retirement Strategies with NetTixis. And Jim and NetTixis have graciously sponsored this Beltway phone call for a period of time now, which we genuinely appreciate. They make it possible for us to bring it to you. And Jim, before I turn it over to you for a few words, I wanted to ask, we're seeing the increasing popularity of so-called environmental, social, and governance, or ESG factors in investment strategies. I wondered, first, are you all seeing the same thing at NetTixis? And secondly, if so, what are you doing about it? So, Jim, jump in and let me know what you think about that.
Certainly, Fred. Thanks so much. And I want to thank everyone for calling in today and for those of us who have been joining us quarterly the past 6 years. And certainly thank you to Drinkle-Biddle for the partnership. I think this is helpful, and we love bringing these types of conversations to the marketplace. And Fred, to your question about ESG, NetTixis, we seek to provide financial professionals more insightful ways to construct portfolios. And we do that through 26 specialized investment managers. And one of our managers is Marova, which is an ESG impact investing manager. And we've been working with them for the past 5 years. But in my world, or in the retirement space, we were trying to identify how we could engage participants and allow your everyday investor to associate their values with their investments. And last year, we launched our Sustainable Future Strategies, which is a ESG target date series. And we've been seeing a great deal of uptick and interest from plan sponsors. And really, one, because I think people want to associate their values with how they invest, but two, really engaging participants so they're more connected to their everyday investment and frankly, to what can be people's only investment within their 401k. So we're seeing a lot of interest. We're excited to have one of the only target date strategies so that these ESG-focused investors can have the same type of diversification and glide path that your everyday investors already have now. So certainly we'd invite you to go to netixis.com to learn more about that, or certainly reach out to me. I'd be grateful to talk with you about that. But we're excited to see a new way to engage participants. So again, thank you, everyone, for calling in today. We're excited about the call. To Jim and Brad, thanks for joining us as well. And Fred, I'll turn it back to you.
Well, thanks, Jim. And if my two kids are a social awareness, a social consciousness is very much a part of who they are. I mean, they just grew up that way. That's important to them. And I think I'm kind of impressed with the idea of target date funds incorporating ESG factors. I know that would appeal to my kids, and if they're representative of millennials, and to millennials generally. So moving on to the agenda, let me tell you what we're going to do with the rest of our time. Jim and Brad and I are going to go back and forth on the issues in the agenda. Then we're going to cover pre-submitted questions, of which we got several. Some we'll actually cover during the course of the program, though. And then we'll open it up to questions more generally. So that's where we're going today. And with that said, let's jump into it. On the first point, you know, since the last Beltway presentation, the Congress has confirmed the nomination of Preston Rutledge to be the Assistant Secretary at the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration. In context, that was a position that Phyllis Borzi held during the Obama administration. The significance of that, of Preston Rutledge being at a desk and as a political appointee providing political leadership to the employee benefits part of the Department of Labor cannot be overstated for several reasons. First, without political leadership, really nothing could proceed in terms of revising the fiduciary regulation and the prohibited transaction exemptions. That's because while the staff can work on all kinds of issues, it is the political leadership that is directional. That is, what direction do those issues go in? So there's now a person in place at the Department of Labor who can provide that political leadership at a granular level. Also, I would say Preston Rutledge was an excellent nomination. He has been a senior staffer in Congress for many years in the retirement plan area, and is very knowledgeable about retirement plan issues. So while the regulation and the exemptions, as finally promulgated, will obviously reflect a Republican philosophy, there is an experienced leader at the helm, which means that not only will they be philosophically Republican, but also that they will be practical, that they will be effective in a way that makes sense rather than just solely philosophical. So having said that, that means that the work now at the Department of Labor can proceed in earnest, and which is why, by the way, you haven't heard anything for the last few months about where is the fiduciary rule, what is being changed. It's because the lack of political leadership. Now you're going to, probably over the next few months, you're going to be hearing more as ideas percolate to the top. Unfortunately, or fortunately now, but unfortunately over the last few months also, there were missing pieces of leadership at the Department, or at the Securities and Exchange Commission, at the SEC. However, those positions now have also been filled via the confirmation and swearing-in process. So, having said that, Jim Lundy, let me turn it over to you to talk about the new commissioners, to talk about what that means in terms of the development of a fiduciary or best interest standard by the SEC, and also to talk a little bit about where you think that whole process is. So, Jim, over to you.
Thank you, Fred. Good day, everyone. Happy to discuss the new commissioners, Robert Jackson and Hester Pierce. For those folks like myself who deal with the SEC on a regular basis, it's going to be an exciting time because this is the first time since 2015 that we'll have a full commission. And while there's been some unusual appointees, perhaps, out of the administration, the appointments to the commission have followed the traditional approach that we've seen over the past several decades. And that's right up through the appointments, nominations, and affirmations of Commissioner Jackson and Pierce, where we see two commissioners go through the process together, one from a Republican conservative background, the other from a Democratic background. And as we examine the backgrounds of Commissioner Pierce and Commissioner Jackson, it allows us to learn a little bit about them, what their views are, and what they may be thinking about in terms of the fiduciary standard. And I'll start with Commissioner Jackson. Commissioner Jackson is the first commissioner from academia to be appointed to the commission since Harvey Goldschmidt approximately a decade ago when I was on the staff. Commissioner Goldschmidt, Commissioner Jackson for a time was a law professor at the Columbia School of Law. He's more recently been a law professor with the NYU School of Law. Academics bring a different perspective and a different background to the commission. Ultimately, Commissioner Goldschmidt was a leading voice on the commission during his tenure. Obviously, we'll have to wait and see if Commissioner Jackson plans to follow that lead, but he is incredibly well qualified, and his background and his testimony reveal somewhat what his perspectives may be on the fiduciary rule. And I'll start by saying that in his statement before the Senate Banking Committee on October 24th, he opened and closed with some very powerful references to his somewhat humble upbringings and the benefits that his parents received from the financial markets and the investments that they made, which allowed him to obtain the high-level education that he received to put him in the chair that day. Very personal views, very powerful views that he shared, and I think that background will likely lend itself to him being an advocate for investors. Not just because he comes from the Democratic background as an appointee, but because of his personal perspectives. You know, that said, he likely will also bring a technical academic view, and I think that perspective may really lend itself well to a lot of the hard work that the SEC needs to do to do a self-assessment regarding the laws that it has in place for investment advisors and broker-dealers. Regarding fiduciary standards, and he has already done some work along those lines when he worked at the Department of Treasury and did some work in rulemaking. So he's familiar with the complexity and the diligence involved in rulemaking, and I think he could be a tremendous asset to the commission looking out into 2018 with all the work that needs to be done in this space. Commissioner Pierce, while a conservative Republican pro-industry appointee, was actually nominated previously by President Obama, and with the change in administration, that nomination stalled. But she was renominated by President Trump. Commissioner Pierce brings a different background to bear. She currently is a fellow at George Mason University, and formerly was on the Senate Banking Committee on the staff of Senator Shelby, which is an area where the presidents have drawn commissioners from in the past. I think there's two issues regarding Commissioner Pierce's background that are even more important. The first is that she previously served on the staff of the SEC. She served in the Division of Investment Management. For those of you not familiar with the divisional breakdown of the SEC, the Division of Investment Management is the division primarily responsible for policymaking and regulations that oversee the investment advisory and investment company issues. So I think that she will have a significant say in how the fiduciary standards will be applied to that industry. In terms of her perspective overall, the other role that Commissioner Pierce played when she served on the staff was as counsel to prior SEC Commissioner Paul Atkins. And I mean this with all due respect to Commissioner Atkins, who was incredibly well regarded. Commissioner Atkins was likely one of the most outspoken pro-industry, somewhat anti-regulatory, anti-enforcement commissioners in the history of the commission. How that impacts Ms. Pierce and the positions and views she will take, of course, remains to be seen, no doubt Commissioner Pierce will be her own person and forge her own path, but as a young professional on the staff, she was part of Commissioner Atkins' team, and he was a driving force for some pro-industry initiatives back at that time. I think that this leaves Chairman Clayton with the delicate balancing act that all chairmen face to try to get consensus among a diverse commission with industry-leading experts of different backgrounds to try to get them to all come together to follow through on the priorities of the commission. One of those main priorities being the coordination and work with the DOL to allow the SEC to develop its own rulemaking to issue a proposed rule. And I think that will involve a significant amount of work. And I think that work also needs to be put in the context of the varying priorities that the commissioners have. While for all of us participating in this call, we all probably believe that main priority is to establish a fiduciary standard, a universal fiduciary standard under the SEC regs that is consistent with the DOL fiduciary standards. I will tell you that based on their statements, Commissioner Jackson and Commissioner Pierce do not see that as the main priority of the commission in 2018. They see the main priority as dealing with the risks presented to the financial markets regarding cybersecurity, and they also see several other priorities after that, amongst of which is the fiduciary rule. So with that context in mind, I think that Chairman Clayton and the commissioners and their staff and the various leaders of the policy divisions, in particular Dahlia Baugh, who is leading the investment management group, they will all come together, I think, and continue the work to try to get a proposed rule issued. I think in reading and following these matters and how they developed late last summer and throughout the fall, I think some of us may have thought ambitiously that a proposed rule may have been coming from the SEC perhaps in the first quarter, ideally in the second quarter. Objectively, I think it's fair to say that there will not be a proposed rule by the first quarter. The second quarter is very ambitious, and we are likely looking at the second half of 2018. I say that with no perspective other than having followed these issues and getting a better understanding of the varying priorities of the commissioners that have come in and what they've said. But I think we're looking at the summer at the earliest for that proposed rule to be issued. That said, I think it ultimately will end up aligning with the efforts of the DOL and continue to move forward on a similar path. Chairman Clayton has been very outspoken about the necessary coordination that he believes is important, and I think that will continue, and I think that's a real positive. I think the bigger struggle will be internally at the SEC, and that's due to the fact that the agency has viewed from a fiduciary standard perspective the regulatory obligations of investment advisors and broker-dealers very differently. And it's that distinction and that controversy that has led to issues in the past of the commission and the staff being able to work through rulemaking to get to an appropriate result for a broader fiduciary standard from the SEC's perspective. There was an effort made to do that approximately a decade ago. It was a very controversial process, and ultimately the rule that was passed was struck down by the D.C. Circuit. I think with that lesson in mind, there will be better coordination internally, better coordination with the DOL, and the rule itself will be crafted in such a way to attempt to avoid any challenge by any outside party vis-a-vis a judicial proceeding and that would overrule the rule. I think the SEC has learned a lot over the past decade, and I think has learned a lot more recently in its collaboration with the DOL, and I think those are all positive things. And with a full commission, I expect that amongst the various priorities, cybersecurity aside, that developing rulemaking surrounding a fiduciary standard will be one of the priorities for the SEC in 2018.
Jim, let me jump in here and make one statement and then ask you one thing. My statement is that I think it's important for everybody to keep in mind that when Jim and I talk about a standard of care, we're both talking about the best interest standard of care, which is a prudent process and a duty of loyalty. But we may not both be talking about the same thing on conflicts of interest. And it's not because it's Jim and me. It's because it's how the laws work differently. By and large, the SEC has resolved conflicts, as has FINRA, through disclosure. Not entirely, but by and large. Under ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code, though, Internal Revenue Code for IRAs, certain financial conflicts of interest are prohibited and can only be engaged in if there's an exemption and if the exemptions are satisfied. So when we say a fiduciary standard, keep in mind that generally we're talking about a standard of care. That does not in and of itself resolve conflicts of interest. So that's my statement, which is keep in mind what we're talking about. A lot of people talk about the best interest contract exemption as if it were a standard of care. It's not. It's an exemption to a prohibited transaction rule. But so there's both. You have to figure both. You have to figure out what's my standard of care and what do I do where I have financial conflicts, or am I going to operate without financial conflicts? So those are two separate things. Everybody should keep that in mind. In terms of my question for you, Jim, it has to do with enforcement, not of current rules, but enforcement of a fiduciary, of an SEC fiduciary rule, if we get one. The industry, I know, is pushing that any best interest or fiduciary standard should only be enforceable by the SEC and FINRA, that it should not be enforceable by private claims. What do you think the outcome of that will be at the SEC?
I think the outcome will be consistent with the industry perspective. Fred, the statute that is used to apply the fiduciary standard is Section 206 of the Investment Advisors Act. That is one of the statutes that is enforced by the SEC Enforcement Division. There have periodically been attempts by private parties to use that in civil lawsuits. That's controversial. The rulings are mixed regarding that's permissive. I think the SEC Enforcement Division view is that it is not, that that's within the purview of the Enforcement Division. And I think that's why in the securities class action and civil action space, most of the plaintiffs and litigants pursue actions based on Rule 10b-5, which has a history of case law that supports it being used and applied by private litigants, whereas Section 206 of the Investment Advisors Act of 1940 does not. And the case law on that is much more controversial in terms of what's out there. And the SEC takes the view that 206(1) of the Advisors Act is best left to be enforced by the staff. So I anticipate if that's going to be encompassed in proposed rulemaking, as we all anticipate, that the SEC will craft a rule to limit the enforcement of these issues to the Enforcement Division of the SEC.
Yeah, the same pressure, by the way, is being made placed on the DOL by the industry to make the best interest standard of care enforceable only by regulators. That in the case of the DOL, rule of regulators would be the Department of Labor for plans and participants, the IRS for IRS plans and participants. The IRS has no history of enforcement in this area. So, particularly with regard to IRAs, and the DOL can't enforce it, so that would be a tremendous new enforcement burden placed on the IRS if that happens. Now, prohibited transactions under ERISA, which would be only for plans and participants, can be enforced by private litigation, because those are fiduciary breach claims essentially. So that's separate. The law is already developed for plans and participants. The real focus is on what will the rule be for IRAs. The industry is pushing for that only the regulators be able to enforce it. And, of course, consumer groups are pushing that people be able to file claims if the fiduciary standard was breached and they suffered losses as a result.
Well, Fred, this is Brad. I just jump in. I apologize for being late. but just to that point, I think that's been the whole fight over many of the deferred provisions of the best interest contract exemption, the so-called full BIC, is that it would, in the IRA space, require that written contract with the IRA owner, which would then, under that version of it, be enforceable in state court as a breach of contract claim on a class action basis. So DOL tried in the Obama administration's version of this to create that private right of action in the IRA space, but I think it's very unlikely that that notion is going to be adopted by the Trump administration in whatever amendments they make. That said, that's all still under review, and that's part of what we'll see here in 2018 is what changes do we get proposed by the Labor Department in the exemptions and potentially in the rule itself that would address that enforceability in IRA space issue.
Yeah, Brad, let me ask you a question about that. And I agree. I think the odds are pretty slight that there will be an enforceable claim by IRA owners under the final set of rules that come out, but it'll only be enforceable by regulators. Jim Lundy was talking about how he thinks that with the different philosophies of the commissioners at the SEC, that it's highly unlikely, or at least unlikely, that we'll see anything until the third quarter of this year coming out as a proposal from the SEC. I talked about how with Preston Rutledge being nominated, we've got a knowledgeable person, and now they've got political leadership at the Department of Labor. What I'd like for you to talk about is, do you have any sense of any kind of a time frame of the DOL coming out with something? Do you think they're going to follow the SEC, leave the SEC, be at the same time? What do you see happening over the next 12 months?
Yeah, so we don't have an official answer to that. You know, there's the semi-annual regulatory agenda that comes out that, you know, shows the next stage in regs and puts out at least a month by which they think something will happen. And if I recall, on the SEC, that month was October, although it may well shift, and you know those projections don't usually stick. it's just kind of the nature of the regulatory process. In DOL, we don't have a particular month that we're expecting the next set of sort of proposed changes to the fiduciary rule or the exemptions to come out. But I think probably fall is a reasonable estimate. If you assume that they need to complete their changes by July of 2019, which is when the deferred provisions of the current exemptions, you know, the worst parts, so to speak, the most onerous parts of the best interest contract and the changes to 8424 and so forth, those will take effect in July of 2019 unless some other change is made. So that really is kind of the deadline, practically speaking, for action by DOL. And in some ways, I think it's kind of practically the deadline for the SEC also. I think both of the agencies need to have their new plans in place and moving by roughly that time frame to avoid further conflict and problems in how their rules work. So if you work backwards from that, really DOL would need to put out a proposal by the fall, roughly, for what changes it wants to make in order to provide enough time for the comment period, which would be, you know, at least 60 days, to then, you know, work through the comments and come up with final rules and publish them by roughly July. So I think the fall is a good sort of time frame for that. We are fortunate that Preston Rutledge is a guy who has been able to hit the ground running by virtue of his experience in employee benefits, having served on the Finance Committee since 2011. He's familiar with the issue as well as employee benefits and the ins and outs of prohibited transactions and all of those issues. So he's able to, you know, have been put into his position and immediately start working without kind of a ramp up that we might have needed with a different nominee. So I think that lets the department move quickly and make that a realistic time frame for it to act on. That said, he's still got a lot he needs to deal with. I mean, he's coming into a situation where, yes, he's no doubt been following this issue, but that's different than sitting down in, you know, a series of however many hour-long marathon staff meetings to go over the primary comments on each of, say, 30 or 40 issues that have been teed up by the comments on the rule, by the responses to the request for information. You know, there's a lot of there that we haven't discussed in terms of the details of the rule, in terms of questions about how some of its provisions apply in terms of problems. Mostly what we did in 2017 was talk about timing. When would the rule go into effect? Which parts? 2018 is going to be about sorting through the actual content. And that is going to take them a while to do because there's just a lot there that we've not really had discussions with the department on until, and we wouldn't have been able to really until now, now that we've got political leadership able to start engaging on those issues.
So at some level, the moral of the story is like the old military saying, hurry up and wait?
From the outside, it may look like hurry up and wait. I think from the inside, it's just going to be hurry up and work because they've got a lot to plow through and consider. I mean, you know, in some respects, all of us who've been talking to the Labor Department over the last couple of years about this rule have been having conversations with the career staff or with the previous administration. Those conversations are informing where they are today, but now it is fundamentally different because it's this administration that ultimately is going to make the policy decisions that go into what the new rule or the new reformed rule will look like. And so some of these conversations have to be had anew. So even, you know, from the outside, it may look like hurry up and wait, but it's also going to be go over and meet, talk to them, explain some of the issues again, as they may have been explained before, but now there's a slightly different audience, so we need to explain them again. So I think 18 is going to be a flurry of activity as everyone goes in to discuss the rule and what should or shouldn't be in the final version, the final version, so to speak.
Final. And as a betting person, I would bet that no matter what rules we see, they won't be applicable in 2019. I think we may get final rules, but they're not going to be applicable until at least 6, maybe 12 months after that. So we could even be looking July 1, 2020, rather than July 1, 2019, before compliance is required. More realistically, maybe January 1, 2020. So I think that this is going to be a long, drawn-out process. But keep in mind that the fiduciary definition itself is in place. It came in place June 9 of last year. And the transition exemptions are in place. So we're not talking about all the rules becoming effective in 2019 or 2020. We're talking about the more complex, more burdensome portions of the rules. The essence of the rules are in effect right now. Rob, let's move on from the federal fiduciary rule, the state fiduciary rules. And let me start off by talking about New York, and then maybe you could talk about Nevada and Connecticut. With regard to New York, there is a proposal for New York State for a fiduciary rule that would apply to sales of insurance products, particularly annuities. It is a regulatory proposal that is not yet applicable, but all signs are that it will become applicable. I mean, as you know, New York has among the most stringent, probably the most stringent regulation of insurance sales products and companies of any state in the union. So there's no reason to think they would back off of this. It is the most similar to the federal fiduciary rule in terms of a standard of care. So I think it's just a matter of time until New York has effectively a fiduciary standard of care, a best interest standard of care, a duty of prudence and a duty of loyalty for the recommendation of insurance products generally to whether it's personal, IRA, participant, or plan. So that's going to be a significant change in the face of state regulation around the country. So, of course, that creates the specter of every state or many states having different regulations governing the standard of care for the sale of insurance and securities products. Now, the one securities product that would cover would be variable annuities. While I say it's insurance, keep in mind that some insurance products are treated as securities products as well. So, Brad, with that introduction, let me segue over to you and talk about Nevada and Connecticut.
Well, yeah, just one last thought there on New York, and this, I think, illustrates the real risk of having all the states potentially start pursuing this, is in under that New York proposal, if you were selling a variable annuity, if you were a producer selling a variable annuity to an IRA owner, you could simultaneously be subject to the New York fiduciary standard, the DOL fiduciary rule, and if the SEC completes a uniform fiduciary standard, an SEC rule as well. And that illustrates the potential problem here, is minor variations in those standards could result in a real regulatory whiplash on folks.
Brad, that's already the case, though. It's just that there's the securities law suitability standard, there's the New York suitability standard, and there's the federal fiduciary rule. So there are already multiple varying levels of regulation. I'm not saying it's good, don't get me wrong. I'm just saying it's already there. It already exists.
No, and I
a single standard.
Well, yes, I think we all recognize that we do have simultaneous regulation. Historically, though, these have been much more in sync, and when we start having different new fiduciary standards, which presumably are even higher than the existing standards in terms of their obligations, then we run the risk of them no longer being appropriately in sync, or being less in sync than they are currently, recognizing that there are still some rough spots, let's say, in various regulatory fitting joints here across the country. But to that end, to illustrate a few others. So in Connecticut, there is a sort of disclosure-based requirement where you can find out whether your advisor is a fiduciary, and there's also some mandatory disclosures that are interestingly applicable at this point only to governmental 403B plans, and so that's sort of the approach that's been taken in Connecticut. In Nevada, the state legislature passed a statute that applies a fiduciary standard to securities regulation. Unlike New York, it's an actual state legislature new standard they passed, and unlike New York, it applies to securities but not to insurance. And the state securities regulator has been working on developing a proposed regulation to implement that state statute. They had a public hearing at which a lot of different interested parties went to testify to address concerns about how this would fit with the fiduciary rule, with potential SEC activity. And there's some discussions here about the degree to which some of these state statutes might be preempted. In particular, there's some decent preemption, so to speak, in the securities area. So there are questions as to how much states could do in security regulation that might be preempted by federal law. Probably it's much harder to see preemption be very effective in the regulation of insurance, given some of the deference to state laws that goes on there. So we've seen a number of states take actual concrete steps. We've seen a number of other states discuss whether they want to take steps. So states like California, New Jersey, there are a variety of other states that are thinking about this issue. And I think one of the interesting things we'll watch here in 2018 is the extent to which developments in the fiduciary regulatory fights at the SEC, at DOL, and potentially the resolution of court cases, for example, attacking or challenging the DOL rule as being invalid, whether those outcomes encourage states to take action or discourage them. We also have the NAIC that has put forth a proposed model rule on annuities, amendments to that model rule. The comment period on that just closed last week. So we have the NAIC potentially looking at moving forward with a standard that could be adopted by other states as well. So there's just a wealth of activity on this front, and how problematic it is, I think, depends on how aggressive states choose to be and how all of these different standards might interact with sort of the DOL rule and or the SEC rule when it comes, assuming it comes, which I think it will.
Yeah. Just one quick statement. There's a statute in New Jersey that Brad alluded to that would require that somebody who's not a fiduciary affirmatively state, I am not a fiduciary, I am not obligated to act in your best interest. Needless to say, there's been a tremendous blowback on that. But it's just it's just a bill in one house of the state legislature. it's nowhere near long long enoughly through the process to be considered a rule that that has to be complied with now. Brad, let me move on to talking about some of the areas where we see problems with compliance with the fiduciary rule that's in effect now, and then we'll segue from that into talking about what the SEC is examining. Let me start by saying the area I'm most concerned about are recommendations of distributions from plans and rollovers to IRAs. That is the one area that applies to RIAs as well as broker-dealers, and in which they have the alternatives of either providing education about rollovers, but then it has to be relatively complete biased education that doesn't suggest a particular outcome, that is, leaving the plan versus rollover to an IRA doesn't suggest, or making a recommendation, in which case the advisor needs to have information about the investments, services, and expenses in the plan, compare those to the investment services and expenses in an IRA, and in light of the participant's needs and circumstances, and then make a recommendation. It has to be done loyally, it has to be done prudently, and it has to be done with all the relevant information, and I just described much of the relevant information. It's the gathering of information about the plan that where I'm worried that people aren't doing it. Now, there are certain circumstances where industry averages can be used. For example, if the participant is requested to provide the information, the participant refuses to provide it or can't find the information. And in that case, with an adequate warning and writing, then the advisor can make a recommendation. But I haven't seen any of those warnings at all, and yet I know people are using industry averages. And I haven't seen that a prudent and diligent effort is being made to obtain the information, which is required, before the warning is given and before the alternative data issue is. And so I'm just in talking to people in the industry, I'm concerned that folks are short-circuiting the process in a way that is not compliant. And I'm worried that there may be a lot of violations out there, inadvertent violations, but violations nonetheless. So that's my area of greatest concern. Brad, let me turn it over to you.
Yeah, I think that's a great one, Fred, and I've seen that as well. And one thing I would point out in response to that is, you know, we have an enforcement policy from DOL that says essentially they're not going to go out and make enforcements against you for mistakes, provided you have been acting, working diligently to comply and acting in good faith. And where they've put out pretty clear guidelines for when you can use things like Form 5500 data in lieu of the actual information, when you can use, you know, benchmarking for plans of that size in lieu of the actual information. You know, if you haven't made an effort to incorporate that in the process and explain why you were essentially able to turn to that alternative information, I think there's a risk that DOL could look at that and say, well, maybe you aren't really working diligently, you aren't acting in good faith if you're not following what's been clear guidance that they put out from the beginning. So, you know, I think people can get a little too complacent about where is DOL going to be on enforcement, because while we have not seen DOL go out and do what I would call enforcement that we'd have a concern about. In other words, I haven't seen DOL enforcement activity that's been going out into the industry and really going after people for how they're complying with this rule yet. That doesn't mean that that isn't coming. And I think the farther away we get from June 9th, the harder it's going to be to justify not having adopted some of the requirements that are out there, like when can you use this alternative information. But one other area that I've seen a lot and that worries me a little is when I'm out talking to groups of advisors of different kinds, and it's similar theme to Fred's, it's this question of distribution and how the rule applies. And I think there's still confusion that DOL has taken the position that this fiduciary rule applies to advice regarding the reinvestment of the proceeds of a distribution, even including required minimum distributions. So if you're telling someone, hey, you've got an RMD coming up, let's use it to do X, that would be subject to the fiduciary rule, the way it's written, regardless of, in some ways, regardless of what X is. X could be a standard life insurance purchase for reasons other than retirement planning. But if it's made while these assets are still in the plan and the distribution hasn't been taken yet, then it's going to be subject to this rule. And I think there's still confusion out there, particularly among advisors who aren't traditionally just retirement advisors, about when this rule applies and what it means. And I think a lot of the financial service providers have tried to address this in terms of the forms that need to be filled out and in terms of the questions they're asking as part of, say, the underwriting process. But it's still an area that I think is one that has a lot of confusion and raises some questions about, if the rule does apply and they don't realize it, have they actually gathered all the data necessary to show a prudent recommendation related to that conduct? And that's an area where I think there's still confusion and still probably some more work to be done by some of the service providers in making sure that they've asked the right questions on the various paperwork to ensure that those rules are being met in that circumstance.
Yeah, and just to highlight what Brad said, but also more broadly, for any advice to IRAs, for example, if there is a privative transaction, that is, if your advice to an IRA is anything other than a pure level fee, no other money anywhere, anyhow, you need to comply with the best interest contract exemption with BICE in order to get, even under the transition rules, in order to be able to receive your compensation. Okay, but the burden of proof of compliance is on the advisor, not on the customer, because it's an exemption to a prohibited transaction. So make sure that your best interest process is documented, how you did the asset allocation, how you selected the investments, how you recommended the distribution by balancing all the considerations that we've talked about. The burden of proof is on the advisor, the broker-dealer, the RIA, to show that they complied. Therefore, they need documentation. Just keep in mind, I mean, that's a huge difference from traditional thinking. And therefore, processes have to be documented. Jim, let me flip over to you. I've got about, you know, in the interest of allowing time for questions, we've only got about 4 minutes, but could you use your 4 minutes to highlight perhaps two issues that the SEC is examining or will be examining, in your opinion?
Sure. You know, sometimes new issues are old issues, and what I mean by that is, you know, we don't have the 2018 examination priorities from OC staff yet, but to get an idea of what the priorities are going to be and what we should all be prepared for, I went back and looked at the priorities for 2017, and, you know, not surprisingly, it's protecting retail investors, focusing on senior investors and retirement investments, assessing market-wide risks, and then other initiatives. And within there, Fred, and I know you and I have talked about the Retire Initiative from 2014, there's a specific reference to that continuing. So with that backdrop from 2017 and moving through the year, in September, we saw enforcement announce a cyber specialty unit and a retail strategy task force. At around that same time, OC Director Pete Driscoll gave a speech and discussed those developments. A month thereafter, one of the co-directors of enforcement also gave a speech discussing specifically the cyber specialty unit enforcement and the retail strategy task force. And so I think what we're going to be seeing is those are going to be the two pinnacles of the SEC agenda going forward. Cybersecurity, which, you know, I think generally we all are aware of, but more specifically for this audience, the prioritization of the retail/Main Street market. That's always been part of the SEC's agenda. You know, over time that agenda has changed in terms of what they prioritize. You know, we all remember post Sarbanes-Oxley very focused on public companies, then kind of Madoff very focused on private offerings and possible Ponzi schemes. Then we had the credit crisis, and now here we are, and there definitely is a shift where retail issues are the main priority of the SEC. They've always been on the spectrum of priorities. They're now at the tippy top. And then you look at the enforcement cases that have come out. And, Fred, I know you and I have talked about this. While they don't make direct reference to the Retire Initiative, I think directly or indirectly there is a relationship there. You had mentioned rollovers. We've seen some cases in that space. Mutual fund fees, high fee share classes, and just lack of disclosure around that. So those are where I think the commission and staff will be allocating their resources and prioritizing things as we move into 2018. And I think it's a good time for all of us to look at those issues. And then if you go back and you look at the 2017 priorities and some of the pronouncements and speeches that I mentioned last fall, there's some guidance in there. And if you're not already doing it, you may, from a cyber perspective, and I think people are probably aware of this, sit down with your chief information security officer and talk through these issues and come up with a plan to detect and remediate any gaps that may exist in your firm. But I think with the focus of this being, some of the retail issues and that overlap between the DOL and the SEC, I think rollovers is important. The SEC views that as a recommendation. And if you look at SEC and FINRA guidance on rollovers, when there is a recommendation, if it's an advisor, it needs to be done in a fiduciary way. If it's a broker-dealer, it needs to be in compliance with all the FINRA rules, in particular the suitability rules. And there needs to be documentation surrounding that to support the recommendations that are made. Same thing with share classes. There's no rule that says you can only recommend the lowest fee share class, but it does need to either be suitable for the client or due to your fiduciary obligation as an advisor, it needs to be in the client's best interest for you to comply with your fiduciary obligations. And if there's any potential conflicts surrounding any of those issues, they need to be disclosed. And that gets back to what you talked about earlier, Fred, that there's one distinctive difference between how the DOL and SEC view the fiduciary obligations, and one is from the SEC perspective that if adequate disclosures are made, you at least have a fighter's chance if the investigators or examiners show up that you've made the appropriate disclosures. So in these particular issues for the registered investment advisors and registered broker-dealers who, sell a large volume of these types of products to their clients, it's a good time to do a self-assessment and look towards making improvements in advance of the 2018 priorities, which I think will be issued soon now that we have a full commission.
Yeah, Jim, on our last Beltway call, I think I mentioned that I had a client that was being examined by the SEC and got some adverse comments from the SEC where it was a client that was recommending that money be rolled over out of plans into IRAs that were invested in interest-bearing accounts, and that then after the rollover, after the money was sitting there, they would sit down with the client and decide how to invest it. And the SEC did not approve of that process because they felt like it wasn't compliant with the kind of analysis that needs to be made. My recollection is the client subsequently agreed with the SEC, agreed to change her practices going forward, and that resolved the matter. But if it had been a DOL investigation, I think the results would have been worse for the client, even worse, in the sense that there would have been a prohibited transaction because there was no good faith and diligent effort to make an analysis of the investment services and expenses in the plan versus those in the IRAs, because there was no the investment to be analyzed in the IRA was a bank account. The analysis had not been done on that basis, comparing it to a bank account. In fact, perhaps there was no analysis at all. So I think that it would have been a prohibited transaction, which would have been problematic. But Jim, I think, do you see the SEC making those kinds of comments going forward? Do you see that as being an issue for the SEC as well?
I do. I think so. When interacting with the examination staff, they're kind of the eyes and ears of the SEC. And obviously it depends on who you draw in terms of individuals and their approaches. But if, you know, if the oversight with the SEC is based on, you know, just a good faith misunderstanding of a process or a regulatory requirement, you can typically engage in a dialogue with OSI's examination staff, propose a remediation plan and appropriate adjustments, and try to head off significant findings or, you know, more importantly and more significantly, a referral by the examination staff to the enforcement division. And I think that, you know, it's always best to try to see if you can develop that rapport to try to cut short, you know, the serious significant findings or the referral. Again, a little bit of it with all of us being human beings depends on the luck of the draw, the people involved, the office, the supervisory chain. But, you know, based on comments by Pete Driscoll, who's OSI's director, who's a friend, he doesn't want the examination staff to be a deputized version of enforcement. He wants them to gather information, engage in discussions, and if needed, educate. And if there are good faith misunderstandings of the regulatory requirements, try to get to the right outcome, which sometimes is simply remediation and not a more aggressive regulatory posture by the staff.
Okay, thank you. Brad, we've got some pre-submitted questions. Let's go through these bang, bang, bang. Number one, does the fiduciary rule apply to HSAs? Will you handle that?
Yeah, so the fiduciary rule applies to any entity that is either subject to Part 4 of Title I of ERISA or that is subject to 4975 of the code. That's the prohibited transaction provisions in the code. And an HSA is subject to the prohibited transaction provisions in the code. Practically speaking, what that means is if you as an advisor tell an individual how to invest their HSA proceeds in the available investments, that is going to be investment advice under the rule. Just kind of a quick wrinkle, DOL has issued guidance since HSAs kind of were created that has explained how an employer can offer an HSA plan without sponsoring an ERISA plan. So you could very likely end up in a scenario where your HSA has the same investments as your 401k. The HSA itself is not an ERISA plan, but advice given to the individual about how to invest within the HSA is subject to the fiduciary rule in much the same way an IRA would be subject to the fiduciary rule. How's that
okay,
for a quick
thanks.
Answer?
And next question. Will the tax law, do the new tax laws affect retirement plans or the DOL fiduciary rule in any way? They don't affect the fiduciary rule in any way. In terms of do they affect retirement plans, the good news is no, they don't affect retirement plans in any material way, because the material ways they would have affected retirement plans would have been negative. And a couple of very technical, detailed ways about the repayment of participant loans and the suspension of deferrals because of hardship withdrawals, there are technical changes that will not impact the overall impact of the popularity and availability of retirement plans. Jim Lundy, let me flip back to you. But first, let me ask the question and give a partial answer. The question is, what about cybersecurity? What are the requirements and what's going on? Very quickly from my end, there's an increasing awareness among plan sponsors about cybersecurity. I'm sure large plans are already doing this, or I know large plans are already doing this. In the future, I could see mid-sized and smaller plans asking all of their service providers, broker-dealers, RIAs, record keepers, TPAs, to explain their cybersecurity processes for any confidential information that they obtain. Jim, you talked a little bit about what the SEC's concerns are. You want to add anything to that in terms of cybersecurity?
Sure. I think, first of all, I'll say the area is highly technical. I worked in-house for a period of time. I found that really strong IT people are on top of these things. They're aware of what needs to be done and the gaps in the organization. Compliance folks and legal folks who try to handle this on their own do so at their own peril. To do this well, you need to partner with your IT colleagues, and in particular, your chief information security officer. There is not a lot out there specifically from the SEC perspective. There's Reg SP, which has to do with personal identifiable information. Folks who follow this have probably seen those cases, and that's about it. But where there's that in terms of guidance is OSI has issued several risk alerts, the most recent one in August of 2017. If you haven't seen those, I'd recommend you give those a review. They're written for a compliance and legal audience, and they give guidance from that perspective to help educate that audience to work through these types of issues.
Okay, Jim, thank you. We're at our hour. I think we're willing to stay on for a few extra minutes to answer phone calls or answer questions. But for those of you who are going to drop off now, thanks for attending. For those of you who want to hang on and hear a few questions and answers, feel free to hang on. And we will end at 5 minutes, 6 minutes after. Operator, Debbie, could you open it up for questions?
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone phone. If you're on a speakerphone, disengage your mute function so your signal will reach our equipment. Again, star 1. A voice prompt on your phone indicates your line has been open. Once you hear the prompt, state your name and pose your question. We'll take our first caller.
Hello.
Hi, this is Mike Callahan. How are you, Fred? How are you, Brad? Really
interesting
discussion today. Hey, there was a mention that there was a change in some of the rules here in Connecticut, and I'm unaware of that, practicing here as a fiduciary for a lot of my retirement plans. What was that specific change?
Brad,
On January 1, I believe it was, the governor signed into law the disclosure requirements that are related to governmental 403Bs. So if you're advising on 403Bs that are related to governmental entities, you have to make the financial institutions have to make certain disclosures about the fees and expenses, and that includes the compensation of the advisor related to those arrangements. So that's one requirement. There was also last summer a bill that was signed into law that on request you have to provide the fiduciary status of the advisor to the customer. That one seems to have been a lot less significant in terms of any real changes that it's made. The 403B one, of course, is very specific. So it's, again, just the governmental 403Bs related to the state.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, star 1 if you would like to ask a question. We'll pause just a moment. Fred, there are no other phone questions at this time. I'll turn it back to you.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. I really appreciate you attending. Jim, you want to wrap us up for today?
Certainly, Fred. Thanks so much. It was a great call today, and thanks to Jim and Brad for joining us today and sharing your insight. I want everyone to mark their calendars. April 19th will be our 24th session of Inside the Beltway, so we look forward to having you join us then. And on behalf of Natixis Investment Managers, thanks for joining us today. And with that, operator, you may close out the call. Thanks.